Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a reading and conversation with French writer Patrick Autreil, presented by the Boston University Romance Studies Department in the College of Arts and Sciences. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Odile Kazanov, professor of French and chair of Romance Studies at Boston University.
Over the past years, we have been fortunate enough to have Patrick Autreil be part of Boston University intellectual life through the different venues. In April 2013, he gave a lecture series, and again, right there, it was already looking at issues of writing and health, on Quand les livres tous se taisent, écrire le moi malade, when books fall silent, writing the ailing self, and écrire la vocation, writing as vocation and beyond. More recently, in 2018 and 2019, Patrick was our writer in residence and taught a seminar through a writer's eye. A psychiatrist by training, Patrick Autreil has been publishing and devoting time to writing for over a decade now. From Dans la Vallée des Larmes, in the Valley of Tears, 2009, to Soigner, to Survivre, which forms a trilogy, and maybe we'll come back to that. And Le Dedans des Choses, La Voix Écrite, to most recently, Quand la Parole Attend la Nuit, 2019, his writing has progressively shown an engagement with the social and political world, yet exploring, I quote, the border places between intimate and social experience, linking medicine and writing, exploring further the boundaries and possibly mirroring effect of the medical world. And I'm especially, when I say that, I'm thinking of his last novel, Quand la parole attend la nuit. Published at the prestigious Gallimard and the Édition Verdier in France, the recipient of several writers' residences in Belgium, Canada, and France, Patrick Autreil's work has been increasingly visible and recognized. A number of his texts have been adapted and performed throughout in France, most particularly Les Irréguliers in Paris, Lyon, Strasbourg, Bordeaux, Toulouse. He's now a regular presence at Le Marathon des Mots, an international annual literary event in Toulouse. In the Valley of Tears that I was just saying is about an inner journey. From illness to recovery, it is about life and death. It is about the taste of life and the renewed taste for life. We're very pleased to have you tonight, and thank you for being here, Patrick.
Thank you. Thank you, Odile, Daniela, and Elisabeth for inviting me at the European Center, and thank you for your presence tonight in this room. And before beginning this talk and reading, please just have some indulgence for my exotic accent. I painfully remember my discomfort as a young doctor when it came to writing medical reports. These short writings were propped up on a representation of sickness and a chain of causes and consequences of treatments and their follow-ups. For the reports to be useful, they needed a simple and reliable narrative. This is how the medical account and the inquisitor come to terms with one another. The report, too, wants the facts. Like all ways of thinking that privilege deductive thought, medicine tends to recruit and command all that it touches through its own logic. No longer gathering or curing with plants, medicine tends also to cut itself from another nuisant weed, one that continuously sprouts up during consultations, subjectivity. And what has always seemed to me since the very beginning of my practice to be harmful was the way in which this distant narrative would engulf the field of thought to the point that it would flush out or disregard the sick individual's subjectivity. Showing the moon in this way, claiming to represent it, but never showing its hidden side. If, for my part, I was sympathetic to this question of the medical narrative, it was because I had grappled with the literary question. Above all, because I made an effort to resist the withering effect of learning and practicing medicine. If I worked towards revitalizing myself through books and films to understand illness differently, all this personal quest was left most often outside of the hospital. I was living with this dichotomy between these two ways of knowledge growing larger and larger inside myself. What made this separation so irritating was what made me cautiously shift the boundaries was learning to write and experiencing that writing led me to some sort of tightrope, a space where you can see from different points of view at the same time. I was led to the mouth of the volcano. It was about losing sight of the supposed split between scientific thought and wild imagination, and about rediscovering the fluidity that exists within the spirit, in between those thoughts born of a different kind of logic. To become a melting pot for these ways of thinking in one draft, trying to join together into one, I had to experience sickness myself, a cancer that condemned me first. That is to say, I needed to become a stranger to myself, an estranged body, and submit to those ends that would consider me to be a medical chaos to care for. Becoming such an object is a source of violence. It brings you face to face with a representation of yourself that risks to devour you all, to transform you into an object before your very eyes as well. Even as a patient, I was still a doctor, and looking at me as a doctor. And these two images of myself were overlapping within me. I was a formal French garden, racked with medical reasoning. I was also a rugged forest grown wild, this terrifying poetry about what was happening to me. I lived, I observed, I listened, I was a very boundary itself. Above all, I began to feel very quickly with the instinct that comes to those who sense death, that I needed to remain spiritually alive. I did not know if I was going to survive, but I knew that I did not want to die already dead. I had known the shock of a death sentence. I had a chance to return from it. And from that point on, when I was offered taxing treatments that would grant me the possibility to get better, I felt filled with a life that wanted to make up all the ground that it had lost. When I was a medical student, I had struggled with an internal hardening and drying up. When I was sick, I struggled not to end up already dead before my death. It is important to have known this tormented might within oneself, this urgency in having accepted the consequences, in order not to panic over having been dropped right at the mouth of the volcano, in order to even understand that it is the only place where we can live to be fully human and fully alive, with a conscious and tamed anxiety of our own mortality. From the moment I understood the seriousness of the threat on my life, and without denying any input from the reality I was living, as a writer, I have been trying to find a sort of writing that I could designate, to use Varlam Shalamov's expression, as a new prose. That is to say, I looked for a means of subjective reappropriation, singular through its means of writing, about what medical reasoning reduced to an aggressive but finally curable cancer. A new prose, or a way of writing for the times of misfortune. Sickness and traumatic experiences in general breaks apart any sense of unity and lays an alarming reality before you. In becoming sick, it seemed to me that I was discovering a sort of wild truth, so intense that it dazzled me, even if I was incapable of defining what exactly made up this wild truth. It was a corporal and physical awareness of my fragility and loneliness, but so profound that to me it seemed that its cavities plunged all the way to the very idea of being alive, and thus into a mystery older than I that overtook me, the mystery itself touching human beings before their very existence. In the first book of the three I've written about illness as an inner experience, In the Valley of Tears, I've described the core of this experience, and I will read to you in a few minutes some extract of this journey through recovery. The paradox was that recovered health threatened to wrap back up this living, bubbling source, and that is what I was refusing before I had even become healed. During the years that followed, finding a new prose has been a way for me to place myself again and again at the mouth of the volcano, not by looking from the outside in, but by situating myself right in between the logic and the dreams. As a human being and therefore as a writer, I've been standing there since, on the boundary, no longer belonging to either side, and even realizing that the reality of myself could only stand there, in this porosity between two visions, between the realms of mind. It has been said that writing is perhaps a manner of re-establishing the unveiled mystery of life. And isn't life a given, as well a secret we cannot grasp? So let me now read three, four short passages of Valley of Tears. I was just about to turn 35 when I was diagnosed with cancer. I had been suffering from periodical stomach aches for several months. The doctors had ordered multiple tests, yet treatment had been to no avail. They blamed my lifestyle, my diet, my demanding job, and I accepted this explanation without being entirely convinced. I didn't dare imagine that something was devouring my gut. After several days without pain, one evening a particularly agonizing episode sent me to the ER. I held my belly like a pregnant animal, unsure of how to accomplish a difficult birth. Despite the crowd that evening, I was seen immediately. It was the beginning of summer. A heat wave was in the air. The humidity weighed upon us. It felt as if the world were about to hatch. They took me toward a large area, the future, perhaps, a place in which moving forward would be difficult. There were gurneys everywhere, elderly patients panting in the hallways, nurses covering bodies, some people fanning themselves while moaning, and others griping because the air conditioning wasn't working. I don't remember clearly the hours that followed. We remain, in a way, outside ourselves at the moment of our birth, especially when, at the same time, we realize we are condemned. I was placed in a cubicle, and through the half-open door, I could hear someone describing a grim case. A resident came in to alert me that my scans revealed bad news. The young man uttered a few words amounting to my death sentence. Light passed through me, eating me as if I were trapped inside a crystal ball. My vision was at once blinded and infinitely clear-sighted. Resigned to wait on my gurney, I gave up all hope I knew. After several hours, they transferred me to another department, to another room, and settled me inside a railing to a bright white bed. Like never before, a hospital appeared like a gate upon which is written, Lasciate ogni speranza voi che entrate. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. I drifted away. For 2 weeks, until a precise diagnosis could be established, I remained convinced I was condemned, and at best had 6 months to live. I could not imagine what would come next, except that I was going to suffer horribly. They had treated me with tranquilizer, and the surgeon had promised the surgery would relieve all symptoms. I needed to believe what he said. I sunk into my bed, watching the bar wall in front of me, the drops from the IV falling like old seconds. Suddenly, everything was eclipsed. Fearful thoughts of chaos and suffering slipped away. I was in a cradle or bassinet, swaddled by death. I was terrified, and yet no longer afraid. At its heart, violence is so calm. I think I lifted the sheets to look at my body, maybe to say goodbye to myself. My stomach looked funny. My body had betrayed me and let an unknown enemy invade me. Facing hostile fire, I retreated inside my head. When great sorrow arises, one is but a mere snail. People passed near the room without entering. I had the impression they were avoiding it. A muffled resonance came from monitors, from faraway voices and footsteps, from the sounds of phones ringing, a little as after an explosion that remains in the ear and in the body paralyzed by the shock, a deaf sound that is neither sound, no vibration, but the imprint of the shock. I floated over a void of fullness and inexistence. I was still alive, whole, entirely whole, not in pieces, but I was no longer at the center of my being. Instead, there was a vacuum full of something without sensory content, a light without light, a presence without body, a consciousness without memory, without emotion. I felt haunted by an unnameable internal unity, cutting me off from everything around me. I was unbelievably untouched. I loved studying medicine. I was a passionate student. The double helix of DNA, the mosaic tiling of cells, the miniature rigging of transmitting networks and pipeworks filling up with life, the mechanics of lipid canals structuring tiny clocks as tiny as the speck of dust, the dance of proteins whose deficiency provokes calamities. Later, after the basic sciences, I loved the complex grammar of signs we learn to pass out on sick bodies. For some years, you see the world through books and then lead to gurneys and beds. You learn things, forget them, and let yourself get carried away, wandering far from pain in the realms where nothing dies except to regenerate in accordance with the great biological circle of life. This body of knowledge is intoxicating and makes you admire the beauty of order and logic in illness, until for the first time, feeling bothered and clumsy, you are confronted by eyes in which one can read the fear of suffering, the anxiety of knowing, anxiety, period. While sick, I sought the aloofness of the biologist. I sought place far from myself and descended towards the elementary. I had to remain logical in the confrontation with this tumor that was threatening to tear me to pieces. Yet, I never consulted medical journals or websites to research a particular type of cancer I had. I preferred to hold on the vague but precise knowledge the doctors had given me and which I had revived my previous education on the subject. I refused to add to the description of frightening symptoms, to read graphs of survival rates and remembers of the carcinogenic effect of the treatments themselves. Didn't I already know enough? In any case, that reality, impersonal and cold as a scalpel, plunged me into a panic if I looked at it too closely. I preferred a whimsical one recreated with certain elements of what they told me. However, at times I was forced to rein in those flights of fancy, to imagine structures crumbling, rising again, hideously sprawling out, matter ruled by the surge of waves out of my control and that might strangle me in cold blood. I felt as if I were losing my footing. I stood in front of a grave that another person, without a name, goal, or reason, was digging for me, the slab already moss-covered. At those moments, courageously avoiding a paralyzing fear, I got a hold on myself. The chemotherapy did its invisible work as I helped it with my will, surveying the crumbling empire from the headquarters of my mind. I'd consider the army of lymphocytes and blood cells. I'd orchestrate the battle and give imperious orders to the hierarchy of my immune system like a powerless king. And when fatigue must made me more vulnerable, if a feeling of foreboding or despondence emerged, I'd exhort all of these subjects to please remain faithful and defend me. I try to gain sympathy from them. Please, tiny blood cell, do not desert me. After each treatment, it would take several days before I found a peaceful state without unease, and again was able to take refuge between the parentheses. Being forced to lie in bed for a long time makes you become sensitive to the slightest of movements in and around you. Small adjustments to raise yourself, a sip of water, a stabbing pain, the orchids flowering on the nightstand, they all have a dense reality. You talk to the space, witnessing everything around, to the water that gurgles at its flows from the faucet, to the ceiling, animated with nice monsters and other not so kind, or with luminous signs dispersing enigmatic messages into the air, to the wall that stoically endures punches you can't throw at anyone else. You encourage a bud, and its blooming makes a morning joyful, a morning moreover when everything is going wrong. Low tide has taken away the white waters of the universe, but it has left behind all types of puddles, currents, and rivulets draining whatever is left of you, and you begin to contemplate them with wonder and sorrow. I kept a few authors closed at end, those who had become my companions during this internal drifting. The shock over, the treatments began, I began to read a lot, following a thread that was difficult to follow. Above all, accounts of unusual and extreme in extreme journeys. I wasn't exploring dangerous lands and confronting unimaginable climate conditions. I was neither persecuted nor humiliated, nor forced to act against my moral compass to survive. I was only sick. I sought help in those voices that described storms and tremendous suffering, attentive to similarities so as to better understand my own situation and find a way out. That's how I came to reread the works of Primo Levi. But it was as if I were hearing his voice for the first time. It's well known that in hell, several circles intersect in a place where you are left alone to fend for yourself, often even against yourself. This illness had thrown me into one of these circles. During the continuous tightening that strangles you as you fight to survive, your values begin to falter. The grueling months of chemo taught me this. For years, I had done my job healing people, yet I no longer had the same compassion for those suffering around me. And this indifference did not make me feel remorse, did not make me feel guilty. I searched in vain for what I had been not long ago, but I found only an empty space, a deflated consciousness. More than anyone else, Primo Levi made me understand that I was crossing only one of meandering aspects of evil. Beyond the circumstances and peculiarities of abandonment in the concentration camps, he held out his hand to me and warned me to not seek illusory landmarks at the bottom of my destitute state, as they would not bring comfort, but only make me suffer more. Rather, Levi encouraged me to put my fate back in the infinite court of lives, really to become aware of my humanity. Of course, the doctors were trying to cure me and not kill me. Yet the violence of this disease and these treatments, the inner solitude the doctors did not know how to console, was imposing an experience I knew I might not come back from, and that I knew was exceptional. I'm surprised I've noticed so many gestures, glances, silences. I saw the familiar hospital and life itself as I had never seen them before. I saw the half of the world that is invisible to people in good health. The quasi-ecstatic state, this extremely dense void that had frozen me when they told me I had cancer, will have been the most surprising stage of my adventure. No amorous state, no event, no other journey had ever produced this exotic feeling caused by the horror of knowing I was condemned. An exoticism that, under threat and on the verge of fragmentation, rejects the confines of any singularity. It seems to me that I had reached the outer limits of a living man's consciousness. What exactly had I experienced? It's hard for me to say and put into words. Fear, willpower, and all desire had been suspended. I had felt a void that completely filled me. I never believed, and I still don't believe, that it was the eruption of transcendence or of a radical altered state. Rather, it was a traumatic vision. I was running into an impenetrable obstacle, radiant, which by eclipsing my ego had effaced its frontier without annihilating its presence. In this internal space, I had experienced an unexpected unity in the vision of a self without ego. It was like a kiss from my reassembled consciousness, a kiss of eternity, or maybe of adieu. And since I did not die, I must belong to the community of the born again. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick, for these different excerpts, and I think it gives you a beautiful sense of In the Valley of Tears and what you do with in your writing and how you explore all sides as a writer, as someone afflicted with the illness, and as a doctor. And the doctor is never far from the writer. The writer is never far from the doctor. There is poetry in the midst and even in the pace, something that the translator was really great at translating and conveying the poetry in sciences and in your admiration for sciences and biology and medicine and as when you were learning, as a learner. And then there is the scientific gaze of the doctor looking at the body in all its ailments. In all of this, there is really, and even in the terms you use in the text, there is a notion of not just a dichotomy, but these two coming together and the porosity or the osmosis between the two fields, the two dimensions, the two sides to a certain extent of your inner self as a writer and as a practitioner. In one of the final excerpts you were reading to us, you addressed the place, or you raised the dimension of reading and the place of books. In this excerpt, you mentioned Primo Levi's reading, but maybe I wanted to ask you if you could come back to that, to the place books occupy in this text.
Yes. In the Valley of Tears is my first book. It has been written in French 10 years ago, so it's been only translated and published recently. So since then, I've tried to explore this relationship between this experience and the reading. And I think the core of the experience of the reading is not described in this book, but a later book. I remember when I came back in my place, I had a very strong experience because I was looking at the library around me and all the books around me, and suddenly, in this kind of very violent environment into myself after this diagnosis, I could not hear anymore the noise and the voices of the books that I loved around me. And I was very disturbed by this deep silence. As Malraux says, it's, you know, all books become quiet in front of death.
So silent, yeah.
And by coincidence, that year, Imre Kertész got the Nobel Prize, so a Hungarian writer who was deported during World War II, and at when he was 15, he was sent to Auschwitz. He survived, and years after, he wrote different books on his experience and deportation. And Kertész got the Nobel Prize that year. I did not know Kertész at that time, and I decided to buy one of his books. And I remember when I began to read this book I did not know, I had a strong feeling that some kind of window or door opened again at that moment, that I was connecting with somebody who had gone through terrifying violence, and this experience was talking to me in a way that none of the writers I had read before had spoken to me. And so I experienced at that moment that the door of the books were open again. And from that moment, I read mainly all of the books of Imre Kertész, and then I went back to the books of Primo Levi, and then to the books of different other writers. The door of the books was open again. So I feel very, very thankful to the few books I have met at that moment. I say met because for me, books are not books. They are, well, this kind of books, they are not books. They are human beings. And they are... And
they accompanied you.
And yeah. They were really taking my hands in that moment, just helping me to understand what I was going through. I'm not talking about the disease itself, but all the spiritual journey, all this... This experience of evil, as I was describing in this book, and trying not to be lost, in fact, into myself, into this destroying capacities that you can discover into yourself, actually, when you are in front of the violence. And so, from that moment, I think all the... my vision of literature and books changed radically. I was already writing. I had been publishing mainly poetry before. But from that moment, this experience of the silence of book and then of another door open into the world of books, but in a very different way, gave me a kind of shape for the writing of the future, for my future into the writing, I should say, quite different from that moment. And I think I became a writer at that moment. I think what I had done before was nothing for me. That moment I had discovered in myself the necessity of books in some moments of your own history, of your own experience of violence.
The necessity of books and the necessity of writing as well for you, to a certain extent.
Yeah, well, and it's true that few years have passed after that, maybe four or five years, and then arrives the writing of In the Valley of Tears in French. And I remember very clearly that I was telling me it was difficult to write this book, very difficult. I made different version. It took me really a few years to achieve a shape and a book which was satisfying to me. But all these years, I was always remembering and telling me, well, I don't know if I'm good. At that time, I didn't know about my future health. But I say, I don't know if I'm going to survive, but... What I know is that I want at least to write one book that can bring to some people I don't know a little bit of what Primo Levi or Kertész brought me in that moment of my life, even though we had so different and so incomparable experiences, actually. But I really wanted to write this kind of book which was coming from my blood and flesh and necessity. And when I've written that, I remember the email of the publisher saying yes, and I remember this kind of relief, but in the same time of immense sadness at that moment, because I had the impression to have run in the writing during years and trying to find a shape, to find what I was going to write, but to find really a shape that was satisfying. And it was a long journey. And at that moment, I was filled with sadness. It was a very strange moment. And I was shocked because when I experienced that feeling, and it's only a kind of very distant comparison, I remembered that Robert Antelme, in his book Human Species, also from his experience of concentration camp, when he was liberated from the camp, he get out of the boundaries of a camp, and then he fall down, and he was not even capable of joy at that moment. And he was very, he wrote a lot about that in his book, about the incapacity of having a kind of joy in front of the mission, which is accomplished in a way, surviving. And I had this kind of feeling, which was very disturbing, because in the same time I was transmitting something. And so since then, I think I have been writing several books on disease and inner and the.
You have almost what can be considered a trilogy, where you have Dans la Vallée des Larmes, in the Valley of Tears, Se Soigner, Soigner, et Se Survivre.
Yeah.
Do you care to maybe tell us a little bit how Soigner kind of came as a natural after something where you were experiencing your own illness? Soigner, meaning to be taking care.
Probably after achieving this book, I think I wanted to write a book about the coming back to the hospital as a doctor. You know, I was a doctor, I became a patient, and then I was going back to hospital and practicing at the hospital. And at the same time, my grandfather was very old at that time, became sick and finally died. So I was with him also. So. I wanted to write a book which was about the vocation of taking care or healing or doctor, which was also connected to my grandfather, and to an a family history of death and disease and trouble in the family, and so it came to me as a kind of it's. There's two books, Soigner and In the Valley of Tears, are like a diptych of this whole journey of a recovery, actually, from the disease to a recovery as a patient in this first book, and then, in a way, recovery as a doctor. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you are, and all doctors who have experienced that, when you are practicing medicine, and then you are sick, very often it changes a lot your way of practicing. Sometimes you change you also radically your way of practicing. In a way, that's what I have done with yours. It took me several years to do that, but because I was not satisfied by the way I was treating people at the
In the Valley of Tears, you speak of indifference at some point, looking at other patients. And so there is clearly you have stepped out of the doctor you were and being the person being ill. But then in Soigner, you come back to that. And rediscovering how you nurture and care for someone else.
I think the second part of this diptych, Soigner, coming back to the hospital and learning how to heal again or to cure or take care again is part of the recovery also, because all this journey into disease is also a very narcissistic journey. And I'm not judging it when I say that, but I think it's, I say most of the people who are very sick in a short period are very narcissistic, and I think it's a survival behavior, which is, for me, a kind of normal. But in order to go back to the others, at some point you have to to take some distance of your own experience. Actually, to write this book, I had also to experience and to understand better the position of the partner, of the narrator of this book. Because it's also, from the moment I understood how the spouse of the partner of the narrator lived this experience from this on his position from the moment I understood that, I could be I was able to write actually this book on my own experience.
In the translation, there is a preface or a translator's note. There is a beautiful recognition of that, of also what the text, how you all kind of, you felt, you, there were books, for instance, felt like a hand being held to you, and how the translator in turn, Eduardo Febles, felt in reading your text and translating your text, and how it was also to a certain extent a hand held to him. And there is something he raises, not just about books and writing, but also about translating and what he learned in the process of translation. And I was wondering, as you reread and worked with him, how you went back to this text, because this is a text that is in your practice as a writer is 10 years old, yet it just came to life or was a new life coming in translation in English this past fall. And I'm wondering if you are looking at it differently now, that you have written these other texts, but also through the translation and through language, having to think of a term, would you write it a little differently now? Were you tempted to use different words?
I think I don't look... When I look back on this text, I don't authorize me to imagine to change anything, actually. I know that it was, especially this text, it was a very special moment, which was also the result of years of work. And I know that also at that moment, I was still not really in good health. Mm-hmm. So I was still in a kind of very uncertain position. And that changed a little bit the writing, I think. Mm-hmm. So I could not write anymore this kind of text. Mm-hmm. And probably also because that is true from this book, but it's true for all the books I've written, actually. I really consider writing as a spiritual journey. And I see myself as an insect which changes his skin, it text after text. So, or a cork. I don't know which image I can give you, but each book for me is a kind of skin, which is not a dead skin, but the skin of another body, and I've changed to write this text. Actually, each text has changed me, and so. You cannot write in a way or a very different one, or using a fictional point of view. That can be done. It's probably one at some point writing about disease again, but in a from a very fictional point of view. That is possible, but that's a very different kind of writing. With the English, English is not my mother tongue, as you can notice, and even if I understand it and speaks it roughly well, the inner part of my body doesn't resonate the same way that it resonates with French. And there was an essay of a first draft, which was not very satisfying with the first translator, and then Eduardo Febles, the translator of this book, came to me years after, and immediately there was a connection of him with this text, and that's what he explains it in the preface, but of his own history and the text. And I recognized in his translation, when I read the first draft, I recognized this dialogue he had with the text. And I think in a translation, for me as a writer, even though I'm not looking for exactitude, maybe, and each time I see a sentence which is not, which does not give you the poetry that I remember having given to the French translation, of course I feel a little bit frustrated. But I prefer to think that there was a strong, very, very intimate dialogue of the translator with the book, and for me that is a sign of success, actually, in the translation. So I was more sensible to that than to the exactitude of a translation. And as soon as, when I read the draft, I felt that he was completely, really into the book. I trusted his way of translating, even though sometimes we were a little bit arguing about
about one word
details,
or the other. I think that could be the final words. Thank you. Thank you so much, Patrick, for this conversation and for your reading.
Thank you so much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation with French writer Patrick Autreil, presented by the Boston University Romance Studies Department in the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Odile Kazanov, professor of French and chair of Romance Studies at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.